Breaking It Down with Frank McKay. This is 103.9 LI News Radio.
I'd like to welcome everyone to Breaking It Down. Frank McKay here. So much more importantly, Thomas J. Watson is our very special guest, and his life work includes handling publicity and business affairs for Lucille Ball Productions, and thrilled to have him, and we'll be hearing a lot about the legendary Lucy and Lucille Ball and everything that comes along with her. Thomas, thrilled to have you. How are you?
Very good, and thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, well, thrilled to have you. And if you don't mind, let's start with a little bit of your history, and let's start from the beginning. Where were you born? Where were you raised?
I was born in the Midwest back in the 1940s, which is not just to date myself, but the important part is my parents had a TV set before they had me, which means nothing today. But in the late 1940s, television was still the new kid on the block. And so I grew up with television as a fact of life. And as kids do with computers today, you know, I have never known life without television. And, of course, Lucy was a major influence or a major presence, if you will, in my life right from, I won't say the very beginning because I started before the show did. I was born in 48, and so by the time she came on the air in 51, I was sort of able to, you know, enjoy her. I mean, a one-year-old or a six-month-old doesn't know much, you know, can't appreciate anything. But by the time you're three, you begin to catch on. And again, I was born in the Midwest in a little small town, but the Midwest part is important because even though the Lucy programs were on in New York at 9 o'clock because it was part of the central time zone, we got it at 8 o'clock, and so it wasn't unusual for a younger child to still be awake at 8 o'clock at night. And yeah. So again, the Lucy programs were there in my life from the very beginning. And so anyway, I don't know life without her. Let me put it that way. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you, so many times you hear different, like social commentary on Lucy. And I grew up with Lucy. I was born in 1967, and it was probably nothing unusual about Lucy. But a lot of people pointed to the fact that there was prejudice, you know, against a woman, a white woman, being married to a Cuban band leader. Any truth to that, or is that drama looking back?
It was insofar as, there was a lot of resistance to it. She was a major star, and in those days, it wasn't that common. Let me put it that way. It just wasn't. It was becoming more so, if you will, because of a lot of the returning GIs came back from foreign countries and had married, spouses from other countries. But it still wasn't an everyday occurrence. And add to the fact that, you know, on radio, Lucy was in a show called My Favorite Husband, which sort of laid the groundwork for I Love Lucy. And in that, she played just sort of a middle American housewife that was married to a banker. And he was very much, you know,
Lily White, right.
A white middle American family. Let me put it that way. And so to have this person be married to a Cuban who was not, who did still speak with an accent he had an accent, and he was a little darker than normal or than totally Caucasian. And so, there was resistance. Let me put it that way. There was resistance. It's not made up for dramatic effect. There was resistance. People said, who's going to believe that this, you know, all-American girl is married to a Cuban? She said, well, I am married to a Cuban. And the CBS and some of the sponsors said, well, we don't think middle America will buy it. And so anyway, there was resistance.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds so bizarre now, but let me remind folks who they're listening to, if you're just joining us a little late, or if you're turning on your radios a little late. Thomas J. Watson is our very special guest, and as I said in the opening, he handled publicity and business affairs for Lucille Ball. Later on in his life, obviously, later than when TV started for him. But I find that so unusual, you having TV that early. I know a lot of people in the 50s, and they were from middle class America, and they said, you know, we had the first TV set on the block, and we're talking about 1955 or something like that, 1954.
Right. Well, I lucked out in that regard because my father sold them. He had a little. He started in life selling radios back in the 30s, and from that it evolved into a store that sold home appliances, which, by the 1950s became a thing, with commercialism and everything. Everybody needed to have a new refrigerator, a washer, a dryer, and da-da-da-da-da. And so his inventory grew as the American appetite grew. But in the late 40s, he experimented with, stocking television. It was very difficult because there was only a few stations on the air. And it was in the middle of Indiana, and you could get signals out of Chicago, and you could get a couple of signals out of Indianapolis. But otherwise, the number of stations was tiny. And if you don't have the stations that have the signal, you can't sell a TV set for people to see snow. So television really hadn't happened yet, but he was one of the guys that believed in it, and so he stocked it. And as you just mentioned, we had one of the first TV sets on the block, and we had the first antenna on top of our house. And people would walk by wondering if the Martians had landed because this strange-looking contraption was up on our roof, and no one knew what it was. And it was such a thing that once television got discovered, suddenly we were the most popular people on the block. People we'd never heard of before were suddenly, oh, can I come in and visit? They didn't want to visit with us. They wanted to see the television set, So anyway, like I say, I lucked out because television was part of my life from the very beginning.
Who else was there other than Lucy that caught your attention? It's limited.
Oh,
right?
There were a lot of shows, but
Jackie Gleason, Milton Berle.
Jackie Gleason, definitely Milton Berle. My mother didn't care too much for Milton Berle, but my dad did. And there were dramatic shows on, like Death Valley Days. It was a Western, and Dragnet, that was an early, the early Jack Webb Dragnet was an early police story. And there were a lot of live presentations and things we don't remember today because they were done live and they, were shown once and that's it. So, there was an awful lot of stuff that was around. But Lucy was one that everybody sort of liked, and that was it. Everybody had their favorites, but when Lucy came on, suddenly the room got very crowded. So it was always a show that a family could watch and enjoy together because it was just universally funny.
Yeah, she was breaking a lot of ground. I mean, not only as a television personality, but just as a comedic actor. Anyway, actually, she was a terrific actor, and a lot of people forget that. I mean, she played some wonderful roles in film, and I don't think she gets the proper credit for her acting chops. Just terrific. I guess rightfully so, because her comedic talent.
Well, she always said she was not a comedian and that she was not able to do things like Carol Burnett or Roseanne Barr and people who could. She wasn't like a stand-up comedian. She couldn't stand up at the microphone and just make stuff up or comment on the news or comment on what was going on in her life. She needed a script. She says, I'm an actress, and I need a script. And, she's an actress who preferred to work in comedy and excelled in working in comedy, but she was an actress first, and You know, she could do dramatic roles very well, but when she did comedy roles, she was over the top. But she wasn't a comedian as such. She was an actress who specialized in comedy. But before we go on, there's one thing I want to say. She would be thrilled, she would be overwhelmed and shocked that here we are in this day and age still talking about her and still talking about her shows, because really the dear lady has been gone over 30 years now, but her shows are still on the air and still very popular with masses of people all over the world, and that, I think, would please her to no end.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's always interesting to talk about a legend, but it's more interesting and fascinating to talk to someone who worked so closely with her. And Thomas J. Watson handled publicity and her business affairs as a member of the Lucille Ball production company. It was much smaller than Desi Lu. That was a monster at one point, was a sheer monster. And I'm sure the divorce kind of split that up, but you can correct me if I'm wrong. Frank McKay here with Thomas J. Watson. Is that what happened to Desi Lu when the divorce happened?
Well, it grew almost by accident. They started as a tiny little company doing one show, doing I Love Lucy. And it started because nobody else wanted it. You know, they wanted... CBS wanted them to fly to New York, move to New York, and do the show live. And they said, no, we can't do that. We just had a brand new baby, and we are not interested in living in New York, and we'd prefer to do it out here. And they said, you can't do it from Los Angeles, because in those days, the technology was not in place yet that would allow a live TV show to go to New York from Los Angeles. It had to originate in New York still. It was, again, very primitive, very early 1951 when all this was going on. And so they came up with a way of doing it on film, but none of the motion picture studios wanted them, because television, even in this raw infancy stage, was considered the competition. And it's sort of like, no, we're not going to rent our real estate to you to come in here and produce something that's going to help take our audience away. So they wound up renting an old studio that wasn't being used and started filming their own shows, and it was very successful. And so as other people were getting into television and wanting to do shows, Desi Lu grew like Topsy, because they were really the only major studio in town that was embracing television. In fact, they specialized in television. And so by the end of the 50s, Lucy and Desi and Desi Lu Productions owned three major lots here in town, a huge back lot. It was a mega operation. And it grew by accident, because none of the motion picture companies wanted them. And when they divorced, when Lucy and Desi divorced, it stayed exactly the same. And Desi continued as president for another couple of years. And then he wanted out. He decided, look, this is just too overwhelming. And she bought out his interest. They'd always been business partners. And they always said, look, if either one of us wants to quit, the other one has the first option as far as buying them out. And so that's what happened. Lucy bought out Desi's interests, I think, in the fall of 63. And then she discovered what he knew, and that is that it was a monster. It was a huge operation. And it was, all the money was, there was not a lot of, there was a lot of profit, but it took a lot of extra money in order to keep it going. And so it was this massive machine. And so by the end of the 60s, I think it was in 67, she decided, look, actually sitting next door to them was Paramount Studios, and Paramount only specialized in motion pictures. They did not have a television department. And so the two sitting next door to each other, there was a TV studio that only did television. There was a motion picture studio that only made movies. So another company called Gulf and Western Industries came by and bought them both out, knocked the wall down, and made what became Paramount, the new Paramount Pictures, from then on out. So that, in a nutshell, is what had happened.
Yeah, it's again, Thomas J. Watson is our very special guest, and it's just it's wonderful talking about her. When you mentioned 30 years she's been gone, it's amazing that she's been gone 30 years. It doesn't feel like she has. And again, I'm 52, you know, which, you know, that's not a spring chicken, but still, I remember when she passed, and you know, wow. Frank McKay here with Thomas J. Watson talking about a woman who changed television and entertainment forever. And I don't know that younger listeners understand who Lucille Ball is and was, and the impact that she had on society. But just a tremendous, tremendous talent, but also a tremendous brain, you know, wrapped up in that talented body. Again, when did you first meet Lucy, and when did you, how soon after meeting her did you start to work for her?
Oh, it was quite a ways. I grew up in Indiana, I wound up going to a school where I was allowed to major in radio and television. I knew from the beginning I wanted to be involved in television in some way, shape, or form, because I had said earlier, it was always a part of my life. And after I graduated, I went to New York and got a job with an ad agency. And total luck of the draw, the ad agency, it's been merged many times over the years, but it was originally called SSCNB. One of its clients was Lever Brothers, and one of its the major shows on the air was the Here's Lucy series. So my very first job was to go to CBS every week and watch the preview of the coming week's Here's Lucy show to make sure all the Lever commercials were in the proper place. And talk about being in heaven. I mean, you know, here I am, a major Lucy fan, and my first job is to make sure all of her commercials are in the right place.
Wow.
And it was like,
yeah,
you know, pinch me, please.
Again,
and to get paid, yeah, and to get paid for it.
Yeah, just, you know, tremendous. What type of boss was she? Was she a demanding?
Yes and no. She didn't suffer fools. She gave 110% to everything she ever did, and so she sort of expected everyone else to give at least as close to 100 as they possibly could. And so no, she was not mean or bossy or anything like that, but she, you know, she expected you to do your job, and but that didn't mean that, you know, it was grueling or anything like that. It's just that you were hired to perform a function, and as long as you were performing that function, everybody got along great. It was when things weren't getting done that, you know, sometimes things got a little unpleasant. But that's true in any job.
Yeah. Was it easy or difficult to get her to share things from the past?
No, it depended on the day, the mood, the moment. I worked with her toward the end of her life, or toward the end of her career, on a day-to-day basis. And so by that point, she was a little bit more nostalgic, maybe, than she might have been earlier, because earlier in her career, she was very, okay, what do we do today type of thing, and she was very work-oriented, getting the show on and that sort of thing. And when she didn't have a show to do every week, then she could be a little bit more reminiscent of things in the past. Plus, and it's kind of sad to say that Desi had been diagnosed with lung cancer in the mid-80s, and so he was constantly on her mind. And so it's a little tacky to reminisce about your first husband when your second husband is around. So when she and I were alone working in the office or working out at her house, she felt comfortable talking with me about you know, things that went on with Desi and whatnot. And so, she was not afraid or sad at all about talking about the past. And sometimes, you know, they were great, wonderful memories. And so, I hope that answered your question.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I think, certainly.
And plus, the last year of her life, she'd finally been talked into consider writing a book. And one of the things that she and I worked on was her mother, Dee Dee, had been a big scrapbook lady from way back. She saved every scrap of paper that had her daughter's name on it and glued them into scrapbooks. And Lucy literally had a closet that was filled with scrapbooks that went all the way back to when she was in high school in Jamestown, New York. I may have a scrapbook that will go back to my high school days, but trust me, it would be a pretty thin. This lady must have had 30, 35 huge scrapbooks. And it's because, like I say, her mama saved everything. I mean, her daughter's name was in the paper. But unfortunately, when you're Lucille Ball, your name's always in the paper. Mm. And so, but anyway, so we were going through her scrapbooks and trying to get things organized because she was going to be sitting down with someone to tell, to reminisce and write a book. Unfortunately, she herself passed away before they got to that stage. But that's what we were doing the last few weeks of her life. She was very easy to talk to as far as tell me about what happened back in such and so and such and so and such and so time. And she remembered an awful lot. A lot of times on talk shows, she would kind of fib because if one of the hosts would say, okay, Lucy, tell me about such and so, she would laugh and say, oh, who remembers that? And that was sort of a fib insofar as she remembered a lot. She just didn't always want to share everything. And to tell you, to illustrate what kind of a really nice lady she was, if someone would call her and say, we're doing a book about such and so and such and so, she would always call that person. Not the writer, but the topic of the book. You know, I remember specifically she asked, we got one letter, wanted to write about a book about B. Arthur. Somebody else was writing about Cary Grant and people like that. And so whenever those requests came in, she didn't dismiss them out of hand, but she called up B. Arthur, and she'd call up Cary Grant or whomever and say, look, this guy is writing a book. He wants to interview me. Are you in favor of this book or is this, you know, anything you're involved with? And if the celebrity said yes, please speak with him, then that was fine. But if the celebrity said no, I don't know who the devil this is, get rid of him, she did that too. She did not believe in kissing and telling. And so if she was on your show, Frank, and someone later said, you know, tell me everything you know about Frank, she would not tell a soul anything without clearing it with you first. She did not believe, because she believed if you were working, particularly if you were working together, you had sort of a unspoken relationship as far as that what went on between the two of you there on the soundstage or in your radio studio was sort of, it's work product. It's stuff that happens when we're working on a project. And it's not, and you got to know that it's not going to be in the newspaper tomorrow, you know. So that kind of work ethic, unfortunately, doesn't always exist in this day and age. But she had it because she came up through the star system of the old studios and whatnot, and there were rules.
Yeah, Thomas J. Watson is the voice that you're hearing, Frank McKay, here with the gentleman who once handled publicity and business affairs for the great Lucille Ball. And if you stepped away, let me remind everyone, you're listening to Breaking It Down. And again, Thomas J. Watson is the gentleman who handled publicity and business affairs for Lucille Ball, and thrilled to have him here. And, you know, what you're describing in our short time with you is just a tremendous class, you know, a lot of class in an individual, and that's everything I've ever heard about her. Let me ask you, if you don't mind, about Gary Morton, her second husband. I don't know all that much about him. I don't know that the world knows all that much about him, but what can you tell us about Gary Morton?
He was my immediate boss. I mean, he ran the company, Bluefield Ball Productions, and I had a great working relationship with him. He was always open and honest, and you could ask him anything, and he would tell you right to your face, good, bad, or indifferent. He'd totally let you know where you stood on any topic, and if it had to do with his wife, he'd sometimes say, well, you'll have to ask Lucy because I really don't know. And again, being totally honest, the two of them were each other's best friend. They knew where each other were every minute of the day. Now, I know some married couples may find that stifling. They didn't. You know, he would, if he was going to be in the office, he'd leave the house and 9 o'clock in the morning and drive into the office, and that's where Wanda Clark, their secretary, and I were, you know, in the office area, and you'd be there most of the day, have lunch, usually either with business associates, or sometimes we'd order pizza in, and then sometimes If it was a slow day, he'd leave the office, you know, middle of the afternoon, go play golf. But he was always, on his way to the golf course, he'd call home and say, hi, honey, how are you? I'm going to go shoot a few holes of golf. I'll be home for dinner. If she was going to, she'd let him know if she was going to the hair, to get her hair done, or going to a rehearsal, or going, they knew where, how to get in touch with each other. Now, today, that's not so difficult because we all have cell phones. In those days, we only had landlines. Yeah. And although Gary was also, he loved new. He loved new and different. And he was the first guy I ever knew that had a car phone. Wow. Now, part of that had to do with the fact that he had money. But you know, because you and I probably couldn't have afforded it back then. But anyway, he had a car phone. So yeah, if he was driving to the golf course, he'd pick up the phone and you know, dial it as he was leaving the garage. And so anyway, you know, he's in the gizmos. But anyway, they knew who each other was, not because anybody ever made any rules. Now, I want to know where you are. It's just that that's the way they were. They were each other's best friend. And so for me, that was a very delightful situation, you know. And I remember one time he was supposed to be, he left the golf course and he was supposed to go pick up Lucy at the house about 5:30 or so. And they were going to go out to dinner with some friends. It got to be 5:15, and she started calling me at the office. Where is he? He's supposed to be home here. He has to change clothes. Da 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 da. I said, Lucy, I don't know. He was supposed to have left the golf course 5 o'clock. Well, I don't know where he is. And she was frantic. And it turned out that he was caught in L.A. traffic. We had L.A. traffic even back then. And this is the late '80s, and he turned into a street, and the cops were at one end of the street, and there was an accident on the other, and they couldn't, and the cars couldn't back out, and they were just, everybody just had to wait until the cars got, you know, that were involved in the accident, got towed away. But she was frantic, not because the dinner date was overdue. She didn't know where her husband was. She didn't know where her best friend was, and she was worried. She was, you know, visualizing maybe he's laying dead in the side of the road. And so anyway, like I say, that was their relationship. They loved each other and were best friends.
Yeah. Voice again. Yeah. The voice again you're hearing is Thomas J. Watson. We're talking about the great Lucille Ball. He handled publicity and business affairs for Lucille Ball and worked with Gary Morton directly under him as her husband. And what a career and what a wonderful job opportunity that was, especially if it was a lifelong Lucy fan. Thomas J. Watson, Frank McKay here. And you've dealt with, a lot of press, over the course of the years. What was her demeanor towards, let's say, criticism or critics in general? Was she, it's almost a rhetorical question. Who likes critics? It's the easiest thing in the world to be as a critic. But how did she handle that kind of, system? And again,
not well. No one likes to be criticized, as you say, and I worked with her during the period of time in which, during the period of time I was working with, it was also the period of time where she was involved with her last TV project called Life with Lucy, which was not successful. Now, I have always said it was successful. It would have been successful had it starred Tom Watson and Frank McKay. It was not successful since it starred the great Lucille Ball, insofar as everyone assumed Lucy coming back to television would have again had these monstrous-sized audiences, and it didn't. But it did not have a zero audience either. It had a fairly respectable audience. It's just that everybody was expecting, gold, and it wasn't there. And the critics were very nasty, and she took it with a grain of salt, but at the same time, because she'd been in the business. She'd been in the business since 1933 or something like that when she first made her first movie with Eddie Cantor, so she'd been around. She's no fool. She knew, every time you step out on the stage, you're putting yourself in jeopardy, and somebody's going to like you and somebody isn't. She was overwhelmed by the negativity, and part of it was the fact that so much of it was aimed at her age. Why is she coming back at her age? And she thought that was ageism, if you will.
Yeah.
And
it is. I mean, let's face it, it really is. And to bring that up, I think people nowadays. And obviously, there's more critics, and everybody's got a Facebook account and whatever. So,
everybody has an opinion today.
Yeah, but still, I think that the credible reporters, entertainment reporters out there, might be more careful because of political correctness to bring up her age. And I don't know. Maybe yes.
Yeah,
maybe
because
no.
I arranged and sat with her through dozens of interviews prior to that show going on the air. Throughout the summer, when we were producing the first few episodes, every lunch hour of every day, she would have a sandwich with in her dressing room with a visiting reporter, and she got the best of the best. All the reporters, like from the New York Times, the Washington Post, all the major newspapers around the country sent their TV columnists to Los Angeles to interview Lucy, and that was wonderful. But a lot of them, the other criticism was for the show itself, saying, good, bad, or indifferent, it was out of step with the times. It was very much a similar type of show as she was doing in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, and now we're in the end of the 80s, and it did not have the flavor of the Golden Girls and some of those, and the Roseanne show and Murphy Brown and things like that, where the comedy was very topical and very au courant, and, she was still playing sort of slapsticky type of humor, which was her stock and trade. It's just that a lot of the reviewers felt it was too old fashioned, and so that was more, again, as a matter of taste, but it was almost universally panned for being out of step. And the funny thing is, the show was also being seen internationally. A company was distributing it to other countries. And it was popular in other countries, and no one thought anything of it because, you know, they were just so used to seeing, you know, Lucy and Ethel in the original series and Lucy and Gail Gordon in some of the later shows do these silly pranks. And so to see them now doing them, you know, yet again, they didn't think anything of it. They just thought it was another great Lucy show, and they were surprised when it stopped, you know. But there again, what can you do?
Yeah. Well, it's I guess fair enough. People talking about it being, not in lockstep with everything that's going. That, you know, I get it. There's part of me that wants to say, well, you know, this is a historic bookend, so to speak, and this was
right.
You know, you should look at it as here's this woman who really started television comedy. You know.
Right. You ask about how she reacted to the critics.
Yeah.
And I do have sort of a story. I won't mention names.
Please.
I won't mention names because it's not fair. But there was a gentleman who was a reputable TV columnist who sort of panned the show. He loved her, but he panned the show and called it a real turkey and da 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 da. And so she got an idea. What she wanted to do was on Thanksgiving, for the week of Thanksgiving, she wanted me to arrange to have a turkey, not a live turkey, but a clean turkey, a frozen turkey from, you know, whatever company, put in dry ice and shipped to this columnist. She wanted him to get it the week before Thanksgiving, and she was going to sign the card saying, no, such and so, this is a real turkey, love, Lucy. And we were getting ready to actually do that, and I made the big mistake of mentioning it to a guy at the network. And he was furious. He said, no, the guy was nasty about our show. We don't want to encourage, you know, that kind of negativity. And so they begged us not to do it. And so she didn't, but I was that. But there again, that's the kind of sense of humor this lady had. Like, you know, you called my show a turkey. No, man, this is a turkey.
Listen, let me tell you, he would have been telling that story forever, and he would have it would have been a dream for most reporters to get it. So, again, Thomas J. Watson is our very special guest. Thrilled to have him. Publicity and business affairs was his purview over at Lucille Ball Productions, and he worked with the late great Lucy, and knew her very well. And I'm just thrilled to talk to him, and I am hoping I can get a follow up with him one day. There's so much information here, tremendous. Author of a couple of books too, if I recall correctly, and I'll ask you about that in a second. But let me ask you this, just to put closure on the last Lucy show, if the current what we know now and you know this point in time and you know, which was, you know, way before or way after Lucy passing, but if the current distribution system where we have Hulu shows and Netflix shows and Amazon and all types of over the top distribution networks, if they existed back then, do you believe Lucy would have continued her show?
Probably, because, well, it was a whole different world. And yes, because the audience base, well, the audience base doesn't have to be as big today.
No.
Back in those days, there were basically three networks. Maybe, I don't remember how strong Fox was in those days.
It was just getting there. It was just getting strong.
But it still is. It was a three-man show, and her last series was put on Saturday night, which had always been a bad night historically for not only television but for ABC, which was the network she was on. First show she ever did wasn't for CBS, and the day the show was officially canceled, the head of CBS called her, and because I answered the phone, and he said put her on, and he said, anytime you ever want to come home and do another project at CBS, just let us know. And so, again, very classy people worked in the industry back then. I mean, he didn't have to do that. He reached out. He knew that she had just gotten the word within the hour, and he knew that she had to have been devastated, which she was. And so to have, you know, the head of your former network call and say, listen, if you ever want to come home and do a project over here, you're more than welcome. And again, and when she passed away, Bill Paley, who was owned CBS in those days, sure, the major domo of CBS its entire life up to that point, went on the air that night. They did a big, I think an hour-long obituary broadcast, and he opened the show by saying Lucille Ball will always be the first lady of CBS, and that's the way the company felt about her, and I think it still does, because they are putting out, you know, shows on DVD, and they're colorizing some of the early shows and putting them on, again, in prime time television. I had would never have my fondest dreams would I think that the Isle of Lucy shows would ever be back on CBS network in prime time. I mean, again, pinch me, those are shows I was watching when I was in the cradle. And so again, the relationships that these people established back in that era are tremendous. And so to answer your question, yes, I think with all the various distribution things going on today, where you don't need to have a huge audience in any one place, but the accumulative audience is still large, I think it would have helped, you know, because I know today even a lot of the shows that are seen on network television, not only CBS, but all the various networks, they augment the broadcast with what is seen, you know, on the streaming yeah, services, like you say, like Netflix and Hulu and those things. And so, yeah, it's the accumulative audience that, and it was, it came at the very end of the three network system, and when every rating point counted. And so, and again, it was a disappointment, because the whole thought of the first lady of television coming back to television was so monumental, and then it sort of, the audience wasn't there. And so anyway, it was a kind of a bittersweet time, but she had a hell of a lot of fun making those shows. It didn't always, you know, she loved to work. She loved to work, and she loved to make people laugh. And so from that standpoint, it was very successful.
Well, listen, it's my conversation with you is exciting for me, and to talk to someone who spent so much time with Lucy, and even to experience that, or, you know, almost especially to experience that, you know, was difficult but historic. I mean, this is a historic conversation about a woman who changed entertainment and changed TV forever, and who knows where the Seinfelds and the Cosbys of this world would be if it wasn't for Lucille Ball. And Thomas J. Watson, I want to thank you very much. The books available, or are they?
They're not currently in print. I think you can still find them occasionally on the internet, either through
secondary
the secondary markets. Occasionally they will show up on Amazon, but again, through an outside seller. But no, they're not in print at the moment. They're all 10, 20 years old at this point. Actually, one of them's almost, I hate to say it, almost 40 years old. It was one I wrote with a gentleman named Bart Andrews. It's called Loving Lucy, and it's a photo biography. And it was one that she liked very much, and she bought a whole couple of dozen of them and gave them away one year at Christmas time. So that was thrilling in and of itself.
Just terrific. Listen, I want to thank you again. Congratulations on a wonderful career yourself, and for really being an eyewitness to history, you know, one of the greats of all time, Lucille Ball. Thomas J. Watson, thank you very much. And
well,
by the way, is there a website or a social media site where people can kind of follow along with you?
Not at the moment, not really. There's an old fan site that I used to use. It's called LucyFan.com, but it's unfortunately, it's still up there, but we don't update it. So it's got a lot of information if people need that, but unfortunately it's not an ongoing, you know, concern.
Well, listen, thanks again. Thomas J. Watson has been our very special guest. He handled publicity and business affairs for the late, great Lucille Ball, and just thrilled to have him here. Frank McKay signing off. We'll see you all next time on Breaking It Down.